happened, and that led to D, E, and F, and so on, until basically your life is the whole alphabet. And the alphabet is people meeting people, leading to other people meeting, until we're old, and then we die.
Or sometimes we're not old, and we die, I said quietly.
Yeah.
Holly climbed on the bed and put her arms around me.
That's true, too.
I'll talk, I said. Next Friday.
And I'll be there right next to you, okay?
That night, as always, we slept with our backs to each other, our spines, as always, touching. Chapter 33. The following Friday, Holly sat next to me and nodded toward the recorder. My own hands were sweating as I pressed the button and looked up at the others. I was surprised how nervous I was. No one had ever said, "Don't talk about your dad," but for some reason I'd buried the story deep, and now I was going to tell it. To my friends. I kept saying that again and again in my head. They're your friends, Haley. They're your friends. But just as I turned on the recorder, Esteban said,
"I have another poem from my papi."
And Amari said,
"Yes!"
Holly nodded at me. Esteban climbed down from the window seat and pulled the poem from his pocket. It was as wrinkled as his uniform.
"I have to keep it on me," he said. "Crazy baby cousin always takes my things and messes with them. I put the other poems up on a shelf, but he can climb."
Esteban smiled and shook his head. He looked tired but happy as he unfolded the poem, holding the page at its edges. His hands trembled as he read first the Spanish and then, more slowly and beautifully, the English.
"And when darkness came, and the night felt like it wanted to swallow me, the echo of 'lights out' was thrown back at the guards in so many beautiful languages that it sounded like the song the world has been trying to teach us since the beginning of time."
He folded the poem carefully and put it back in his pocket.
"It means that there are all these different kinds of people in detention with my papi. And when the guards tell them that it's time for lights out, they all yell it back in their own language. So my papi hears all the languages. And it's like they're singing him to sleep."
Esteban touched the pocket with the poem in it.
"That's all I have to say for now."
He climbed back onto the window ledge and wrapped his arms around his legs, resting his head on his knees. After everyone told him how beautiful the poem was, I stood up. "I want to talk now," I said. "You guys have all told your stories about your families, and there's a story I haven't told you." I looked over at Holly, and she nodded again. "It's about my life. It's about my father." Esteban turned to me. "And my mother," I said, my voice cracking. "It's about what happened to me when I was little, and when I first met Holly's mom, Kira." Chapter 34. The first time I met Holly's mom, I was 7 years old, and Holly and I had only known each other for a few months. Kira, Holly's mom, had asked my uncle about doing my hair, and he agreed. No, he hadn't agreed. He nearly jumped into her arms before she could even get the words out. So the first time I was at their house, when I was sitting in their kitchen with my hair washed and dripping onto the towel, and Kira asked about my full name, about my family, the rest of the group got so quiet. I stopped talking. My throat felt like it was closing up.
"You got this, Red,"
Amari said to me. His smile loosened the words. I looked at Holly helplessly.
"It's okay," she said. "I'm here with you. I can help if you need me."
Everyone nodded. I smiled at her, relieved, and Holly put her arm around me. The thing I've never told you guys is that my dad's in prison.
Your dad's in prison?
Tiago and Amari said at the same time. I nodded.
"For what?"
Tiago asked.
"Did he rob somebody?"
"He was driving," I said slowly. "He was driving a car. My mother was in it." The room felt like it was breathing for me. As I told the story of the accident, Esteban's eyes filled and Ashton put his head down on his hands. When I got to the part about my father running home for my uncle's help, Amari said,
"Jeez, Red, I didn't even know."
He said it quietly, almost under his breath, but in the words there was so much love that it felt like he was reaching across the circle and hugging me. Holly was holding onto my hand now.
"Is he in jail for life?"
Amari asked finally.
"And plus, I'm sorry about your mom."
"He's going to be coming out soon," I said. "I'm not exactly sure when."
"This is too deep,"
Amari said.
"No wonder you're so quiet, Red. You all kinds of still water."
When I first met Kira, she asked me about my people, and I told her my mom died. I waited for her to say something like, "I'm so sorry," or, "You poor baby," or, "Oh, sweetie," but she didn't. She was combing my hair at the time, and she stopped for a minute, and her hand got real shaky.
"I remember you told my mom that your mom died when you were 3,
Holly said,
"and that you didn't really remember her."
"My mommy's still with us,"
Esteban said.
"I feel lucky for that."
"But why was her hand shaky?"
Ashton asked.
"Was she feeling sad for you?"
"No,"
Holly said.
"That's the crazy part."
She jumped up from her seat, then sat down again real fast and started tapping her feet like I wasn't telling the story fast enough.
"Tell them, Haley."
"I'm trying," I said. "Kira asked me if I was Beryl Anderson's child, and I told her Beryl was my mom."
"Your moms knew each other?"
Amari asked.
"That's wild."
"Yes,"
Holly said.
"It's really wild. Our moms were pregnant together. When my mom told us that, I was like, wait, what? You and who and what?"
I laughed, but your mom just ignored you, I said. Kira came around the chair and crouched in front of me. Her face was all worried and sad, but it was happy too, remember? Holly nodded. She brushed my hair back away from my forehead and said, "Your mom and I used to go to Tom's Diner over on Washington after our Lamaze classes. We'd order so much food, the waitress would always ask if someone was joining us." And then Kira laughed, and I remember I wanted to laugh too, but my heart felt like it was competing with my tongue for space inside my mouth. So I just whispered to Kira, "You knew my mother." I stopped talking. It was hard to tell the story, but it wasn't hard. It felt like everyone in the room was leaning in and listening and really caring. Felt like everyone around me wanted everything to turn out all right.
"We got you, Red,"
Amari said quietly.
"You know that, right?"
I nodded, smiled at him, and continued. Kira told me how much I looked like my mother, and how, when she first saw me, she thought maybe it was possible, but it was too much of a coincidence. "But Brooklyn's small when you think about it, right?" Everyone nodded.
"It must have been like a resurrection,"
Ashton said.
"Like here was somebody that could answer your questions."
"Yes," I said. "That's so true. I had a million questions. There were like a million conversations I'd had in my mind with my mother. But the first thing I asked Holly's mom was what stuff my mom loved. I remember she looked really sad then," I said. "It was like she was going back to being with my mom and remembering everything about it. She thought for a long time, then finally said, 'Your mom loved to laugh.' Even when things felt like they were falling apart, she found a way to laugh." I wanted to ask what made my mom laugh, but I didn't. For some reason, knowing that she loved laughing was enough for that moment.
"What about your dad?"
Esteban asked.
"Did Kira know your dad too?"
I shook my head. "She never met him. Kira said once she and my mom became friends, they had, like, their ladies thing going on."
"Like my mom, with her girls,"
Amari said.
"Eating all that food after going to spin class. Women are crazy."
Both me and Holly said, "Hey!"
"Hey!"
at the same time. Amari threw his hands up.
"You know I'm just messing with y'all."
"Tell them about the sun,"
Holly said.
"The magic."
"Oh, yeah. There's a high window in Holly's kitchen," I said. "And this crazy thing happened. The sky, Like, it shifted, and everything got bright. And Kira laughed and said that she and my mom used to always talk about the light. How they thought light shifting was the dead sending us messages. Love messages. She said that every time the sun goes behind a cloud and then comes out again, that's a message from the other side. I looked over at Esteban. He was staring up at the sky as though he was waiting for the sun to send him a message. He had one hand in his pocket, and I knew he was touching his poem. For the whole time that Kira was braiding my hair, I said, she talked about my mother, what she remembered, how they lost touch, how she heard about the accident. And I told her all about my uncle and how he made me laugh and how he always told me that my laugh reminded him of my mom. I stopped talking. No one said anything for a long time. Holly smiled at me and nodded, giving me a thumbs up. I felt lighter, free somehow, like I'd been carrying the weight of that story in me, not even knowing it was heavy. Like so many bricks had been lifted off me. Esteban was hugging his legs again, but he was watching me now.
Your story makes me think that I'm happy my papi's alive, Haley. I mean, because of your story, I can feel some hope. Because no matter what, we're going to see him again. He didn't die, and that's good. Even if everything has to change to be with them again. At least I could be with them again, right?
We all nodded.
He's still writing poetry,
Esteban said.
Him breathing.
He looked at me.
Even though it's kind of sad, what happened and everything. It feels happy, too, that we have each other. Like that thing Ms. Laverne said about how we have to harbor each other. You remember?
I nodded.
I feel like your story does that. You're my same age, and you have to be strong for your dad. It makes me feel like I can be strong, too.
And everyone else said, yeah.
Me, too.
For real.
Chapter 35. I turned off the recorder and put it back into my knapsack. It was almost 3 o'clock. But just like most Fridays now, none of us moved. We'd started ignoring the time weeks ago. It was strange to remember that we'd come into this room confused about why we were here. Now we could barely remember a time when we weren't here.
Hey,
Amari said.
Since we all doing some sharing, before we all bounce for the weekend, I want to show you something.
He opened his drawing pad and we all leaned toward him.
I've been copying some of these comic book guys,
Amari said.
I got some sweet characters. I'm gonna put all of y'all in there too. It's gonna be so, so tight. It's like my brain is frying with ideas.
Amari had the biggest smile on his face that I'd ever seen, which made the rest of us smile and look through the comics. Even me and Holly went over to see what the four of them were getting all excited about.
Some people try to hate on comics, but they get you inspired, you know?
Amari said.
It's like, man, like, look at this guy.
He opened a Black Panther comic. And the Black Panther was big and black and strong on the page. Outside the art room window, the schoolyard was bright and cold. The strange thing is, I don't remember any other sound but Amari's voice. There must have been kids playing. There must have been yelling and laughter and horns blowing, but none of it comes back to me. Just Amari's smile, his comic books, us gathering around him.
Like, what if the Black Panther was just a kid in this school,
he said.
Just a regular kid. That's what I was thinking last night. Every comic book hero used to be a little kid at school once. So what if kids like us are the superheroes, right? The real superheroes.
Amari was talking fast. The other boys were nodding as he turned the pages of the comic books.
Like Esteban,
Amari said.
Who's the Dominican Superman? I mean, we got Miles Morales, he's the Puerto Rican Spider-Man, so we got Tiago covered. But Ashton, who's the superhero whose dad works at Key Food? And like for me, who's the guy who doesn't get to play with guns, so he has to find out another way to destroy?
Amari looked at me.
Haley, I got you too. Superhero girl who lives with her uncle. I got you too, Holly. Your richness is your superpower.
I waited for Holly to get mad at Amari for calling her rich. But she didn't. She was even smiling a little.
I'll take it,
she said.
Just hook me up with a nice cape.
We must have headed out soon after that, because I remember us all walking down the hall and out into the schoolyard together. We walked slowly, still talking. Chapter 36.
What do you think your superpower would be?
Holly asked me as we waited for Kira to pick us up after school. Someone had drawn a hopscotch game just outside the schoolyard fence, and she started jumping up the numbers, then turning and jumping back down them again. I had just been wondering that myself, wondering who the superhero is with a dad in prison. I don't know, I said. What about you?
I'd want super focus, super be stillness. I'd want to sit like a statue for hours and hours and be like a sponge. Everything anyone said to me would get soaked right up, and I'd be the most brilliant person ever.
But you're so smart already, Holly, even if you can't sit still.
But imagine if I could. Then I'd be even smarter. I'd probably be graduating high school at like 13.
But then you wouldn't be in school with me, I said.
Oh yeah, that's right. Then I think I'd want us to have the same superpower.
Maybe I'd want to fly, I said.
Me too,
she said.
That's easy. Everybody wants to fly. But what else?
I thought about my dad. There was a room in my brain where I was mad at him. Some days I opened that door and it made me so sad that I just sat for hours staring off at nothing. Those were the days Ms. Laverne and my uncle, and even Holly, left me alone. Those were the days filled with gray light and cold, damp air. That was the room where I realized I couldn't forgive him. I think, I said slowly, I think I'd want to forget. Holly stopped jumping.
Forget what?
You know, about what happened between my mom and dad. I'd want to just imagine that I always had a dad. That I never had a mom.
But you did have a mom.
I know.
You'd want to forget even the little tiny bit you know about her?
Holly frowned, confused. It's not that. It's just, I don't want to be sad and mad when I think about it all. I just want to think about the good stuff.
Then you want forgiveness, not forgetness,
Holly said. Forgiveness, I thought. I want forgiveness. Standing there, I realized I'd first have to forgive my father. Not forget, but forgive. Holly started hopscotching again just as Kira pulled up in the car. Chapter 37.
Check this out,
Amari said to us on Monday morning. We were in the schoolyard before class, and the day was surprisingly warm. Amari opened his book and slowly started turning the pages. We all leaned in over the pictures. And there we were! On every single page! Tiago shooting webs from his hands over buildings and vans and cars. Esteban flying over an ocean and, far down below him, the same tiny man over and over again with a t-shirt on that said, Poppy. Holly was Catwoman in a fancy building, her sneakers almost bigger than the rest of her, and we all laughed. When Amari turned the page again, there I was, my hair a mass of curly red wires that seemed to be shooting electricity.
That's tight,
Ashton said. It's like I've always had my superpower with me, I said. I was born with red hair.
Yup.
Amari looked up at me and smiled.
That's the cool thing. There's all kinds of ways to get your superpower. You take somebody like Superman, who was born with a superpower, and somebody like Spider-Man. The way he got his power was kind of tragic, right? But then it became this good thing. That's what's up.
That night, as I waited for my uncle to come say goodnight, I thought about Amari's drawing of me, about the brilliance of my hair, the superpower in it. And I thought about my mother and father. Tragedy is strange. It takes away. And it gives, too. I couldn't ever imagine a life without my uncle. His laughing, his stories, the way he looks at the world. But until I saw Amari's drawing, I hadn't really thought about my hair. The power is both my mom and dad running through it, through me, and their moms and dads, and theirs, the A and B of me. The C and D, as Holly said. I smiled. My mother was gone, but she was continuing, too, inside of me. And that was its own superpower.
You ready?
My uncle said. He stood in the doorway, holding his guitar. Before my father went to prison, they played music together. My father on the piano, my uncle on the guitar.
Lame songs about mountains and clouds and rainbows, my uncle said.
But then, when my father went away, my uncle started writing his own music, telling stories in his songs. Sometimes he played them for me. I liked falling asleep to the quiet hum of his guitar and his soft voice, the notes trembling. My uncle had lived through it all. The car accident, my father being taken away, him suddenly being not just my uncle, but my mom and dad, too. He was my superhero. Yeah, I said. I wanted to tell him about the day, but instead, I pulled the covers up over me and smiled. My uncle sat in the small chair at the foot of my bed and started strumming his guitar. Chapter 38. When we came back to school after Easter break, Esteban was gone. Where? We asked Ms. Laverne.
Home to the Dominican Republic. The family left on Sunday.
But he didn't tell us, we said.
He didn't know,
Ms. Laverne said. She said,
I'm sorry.
She said,
let's just do what we want today.
She said,
I know you all will miss him terribly.
Amari looked at his drawings. Tiago put his head down on his desk. After a while, I could hear quiet sobbing. Ashton stared out the window. The sun was so bright. The buildings seemed sharp enough to cut someone. Holly got up and walked around the classroom, pulling books off the shelves and then putting them back again. After a few minutes, she went back to her seat, took out her knitting, then put it back. Then took it out again and started knitting, the needles clicking and scraping against each other. I took out the recorder, turned the volume down low, and played the last poem Esteban had read to us, his sweet voice filling the classroom.
And when his missing feels like it's going to break him into pieces, tell him it won't. Tell him that he's made of the iron of grandfathers and grandmothers, and their grandfathers and grandmothers. People who were human and worked hard and had dreams. Tell him to hold on to his dreams, because his abuela and abuelo still believe in the power of dreams. Tell him he is their dream, and he is my dream, and he is the dream come true of the ancestors. We are all the dream come true of the people who came before us. And when he asks, tell him I am fine. Tell him I am free. Tell him the mountains go on and on. And where they stop, Pico Duarte's peak points up like lips, telling God a story. Maybe this mountain sings of promises and families broken. Maybe he holds inside it a beautifully remembered dream. Tell him to hold inside himself all good memories. Hugs, friends, laughter. Tomorrow holds no promises. But now, it's not the time for tears.
Chapter 39. In June, just before the school year ended, we met in the art room one last time. Amari said,
I'm gonna miss you guys.
Me too.
Tiago said,
Me too.
Ashton said,
You guys are awesome.
There was air in the room where Esteban's Me Too would have been. We had left his desk where it was, left the pillow he sat on in the window, and it felt like a ghost in the room. like he was still with us, telling us about his papi, baseball season, poetry. Me too, I said, looking at his empty seat. I hoped he was in the Dominican Republic. I hoped that he and his papi were catching baseballs and swimming in the ocean. I hoped that the family was together and safe and happy. Holly looked around at us.
It's just the summer, people. We'll be back together in September. It's not like it's for forever.
True,
Ashton said.
But it won't be like this. We won't be with you and Haley. It won't be the art room.
Yeah,
Amari said.
But don't forget our promise. Every day gets us closer to 20 years from now, right?
Yep,
Holly said.
When we all meet back here, all old and gray and wobbly.
I'm not gonna be old and wobbly,
Amari said.
Maybe you will be, but not me.
You already are old and wobbly,
Holly said. We laughed. Even Amari.
Remember how scared we were the first time Ms. Laverne brought us in here?
Holly said.
Yeah, I hated this room,
Amari said.
It was, like, depressing. That one sad picture hanging on the closet.
We looked at the kid's picture of the sun. It was as familiar as time now. Something we saw but didn't see. It was beautiful.
And a lot of us didn't know each other,
Tiago said.
We all just were like, what's this thing?
And it was us, I said. That thing that we were so scared of was just us together.
Yup,
Tiago said. He smiled at me, his glasses glinting. Beneath them, I noticed how pretty his eyes were.
Isn't that crazy?
And Esteban,
Ashton said softly.
Esteban was here. Never gonna forget Esteban.
We all got quiet.
Some part of him is still here,
Holly said.
Yeah,
Amari said.
That's true.
Yeah, the rest of us said. We still have his voice and his dad's poetry, I said. He left that for us to keep forever. Amari opened his drawing pad and flipped through the pages until he came to a brightly colored picture.
That's us,
he said.
And that's a harbor.
He carefully tore the drawing from his book. Then, without saying anything, he walked over to the picture of the sun, pulled one of the thumbtacks from it, and hung his picture beside it. We all stared at it. It was us. And like the picture of the sun, it too was beautiful. Chapter 40. The light has shifted now, and the ailanthus tree has turned to a shadow in the dusk. I turn the recorder off and sit on my bed. I can hear the soft swish of the ceiling fan in the hallway. Outside, little kids on the block are playing a game of tag, yelling, "Not it! Not it!" Then a woman's voice breaks through, calling someone home to dinner. I uncurl my legs from beneath me and head for the stairs. But at the top of the stairs, I stop and sit, watching my father at the piano as he lifts his fingers from the keys and presses them down again. His fingers are long and white and delicate. I'd never really looked at his hands, but as they move over the piano keys, lifting such sweet music out of them, I want to run down and hug him. I want to tell him about my year in the art room, about everything he missed in the many years he was in prison. I want to ask him if he had great friends when he was my age. Friends he promised to meet up with again in 20 years. But I stare at his back as he plays. He is somewhere else. He is with my mother in another dream. A dream of a place before this place. A time before this time. A story before this story. Soon my uncle will be finished packing and will come down to join him on his guitar. Maybe they'll ask me to sing and my voice will be high and off key and they'll laugh about how the musical gene skipped right over me. When I was in fifth grade, I didn't know how fast time could move. How you could wake up one day and so much around you had changed forever. I didn't know that one day we'd have a teacher who would say, "Take your books. You won't be coming back here today." And that we'd walk out of the lives we'd always known. Our faces turned toward her. So many questions and so much fear. "Daddy," I say. My father turns from the piano and looks up at me. "Play Summertime." My father looks confused for a minute, and then his face softens into something warm and familiar. Something I knew a lifetime ago when I was a tiny girl getting tossed into the air by him, laughing and screaming, both afraid and thrilled. When I was in fifth grade, I didn't know the unfamiliar would be beautiful and funny and heartbreaking and hard. That it would be Amari calling me red and the glint coming off of Tiago's glasses. That it would be Esteban in the window, a silhouette with the sun coming in around him. That it would be poems and pictures and questions and answers. I head down the stairs and sit on the bench beside my father. His fingers are long and pale and stretched out across the keys. He smiles, bends, and kisses the top of my head. The first notes of Summertime rising from the piano.
"I dreamed this moment 1,000 times," he says.
I didn't know it would be people you barely knew becoming friends that harbored you. And dreams you didn't even know you had coming true. I didn't know it would be superpowers rising up out of tragedies. And perfect moments in a nearly empty classroom. "Me too," I say. And when I rest my head against his arm, when the music circles around us, when my uncle stops packing and joins in with his guitar and we pick up the song as if we'd always been singing it, what I know for sure now is that this is the end of one of many stories. And also a beginning.
My name is Jackson Leroy Woodoff Woodson, and I'm with my mom, Jacqueline Woodson, and we're talking about her book, Harbor Me.
And how old are you, Jackson Leroy?
10.
And did you finish the book?
Yes.
So I have a question for you. You know what diversity is, right?
Yes.
So what does it look like in your classroom?
Well, the books are actually not diverse. They're barely diverse at all. In my class, we looked at them, and we were looking at, like, religion, skin color, a lot of stuff. Like, LGBTQ, stuff like that. And me and my friends looked at in the classroom, and there were so many books of just straight white people in it.
Did you talk to the teacher about that? Or your teachers?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What did they say?
They were like, "Oh, we should change these books. We should get other ones." I think they did, too.
That's cool, because they were open to it, right?
Yeah.
They wanted the library to reflect.
Yes.
What's the diversity of the kids in your classroom?
Diverse in pretty much any way. Mm-hmm.
So the reason we sent you to that school is because that school really thinks a lot about diversity. You know, New York City has the highest rate of segregated schools in the country. So the reason we didn't send you to the school in our neighborhood was because it was not diverse. We had to find a school where kids looked more like you and they looked other ways. We wanted to find a school where some people had two moms, some people had two dads, some people had a mom and a dad, some people had a single mom or a single dad.
Some people had parent and parent in terms of gender non-specific person.
Mm-hmm. So what kind of diversity did you see in Harbor Me?
In Harbor Me, there are a lot of people of different color skins, genders, a lot of stuff.
Who is your favorite character?
I liked Amari because he said a lot of the things that, like, other people don't say. He was actually, like, speaking out on what he thought.
Do you remember what he said about freedom?
He said, like, their teacher put us in the art room. She didn't say, you want to go to the art room? She said, you're going to the art room. And he was like, is that freedom? Is that power?
What did you think about that?
I was kind of in the middle because I think the art room was a good thing to have. But it's also not right because it's not giving the kids any say in what they're doing.
But she put him in there and said you could do whatever you want for an hour.
I know, but still, I would want to do that, but maybe kids don't want to do that.
What do you think about those kids? Do you think they wanted to?
I think they wanted to because they got to talk about everything that was happening in their life, like Amari with the Nerf guns and Esteban with his dad being taken away and Haley with her dad in prison. What drove you into writing this book?
You know how I always talk about I write because I have so many questions, not because I have answers. And I was thinking about all the stuff. I was thinking about deportation and what's going on with that. And what do we always talk about at home with the Nerf guns?
Don't play with them in the park because a kid got shot by the police because he had a Nerf gun, but it was hyper-colored, and that couldn't have looked like an actual gun.
So we get scared for you, and I think when I get scared sometimes, it helps to write about it and to create characters that talk about it because it helps me to understand it more. And also to talk about what it means to be a kid in a specialized classroom or to be a kid with special needs and to have a really great teacher who understands that. What does harbor me mean? What does that title mean? Do you remember?
Yeah, it means like take me in, protect me. I know that it used to be the dream of America, but then you flat left that title.
I left that title way behind because sometimes I figure out stuff as I'm writing the book. I figure out what the book is trying to say and I think, well, yeah, it is about people having dreams, but it's about people taking care of each other. And that was the bigger theme in the book, the way these six kids really started looking out for each other.
Why did you choose Reading Equals Hope Times Change as your slogan?
For National Ambassador?
Yes.
Because I think when you read, you see a different world than you might otherwise encounter. And when you meet new people through that world, it gives you hope. And it also changes you. So I think we read to look for hope. We read because we want to feel hope. And reading changes us. When we read something and get empowered, it makes us want to go out there and create change.
I meant like, why did you format it in an equation?
A mathematical
yeah,
equation
because
like that.
I know you and you're not really into math that much. So.
I am not into math, but I like the way it looked. I like the aesthetics of it. And I like that they go hand in hand. I think it makes people think of the math of reading, what we can acquire, what it sums up, what reading sums up. And that feels mathematical to me. So I thought doing it as a mathematical equation was a smart way to do it. What's your favorite way to consume books, or what are some of your favorite ways?
Usually listen to an audiobook because, say, I'm walking to fencing or something like that. If you're doing something and you can't use your eyes and your hands, it's just easier to listen to something. It's a quicker way.
So on a daily basis, how often do you listen to an audiobook or how often do you read?
I listen to so much audiobooks. When I have something in my ear, a lot of people will be like, what music are you listening to? But I usually say, oh, I'm actually listening to an audiobook.
That's so cool. It's so true. This child always has a book in his ear.
You know in the book where Haley was thanking Miss Laverne about teaching them about the Lenape? So before that, she would put her hand over her mouth and make that noise. She would think that First Nation people, but she used Indians, were just people with silly feathery hats. Did she know she was being racist or did she not know?
That's a really great question. I think she did not know. I think sometimes people don't know until they do know. And then once they do know, they never don't know again. And for Haley, She felt really bad looking back on her actions and seeing that she was being prejudiced against Native people. As a writer, I think that it's important for me to show through the writing flawed characters, that there are things that we do that we don't even know we're doing that are wrong, right? And then once we realize it, it's like, geez, how could I not have even known that? And so with the learning of the history of the Lenape, who were the Lenape?
The Lenape were a group of First Nation people. The reason they're called First Nation people is because they're before pretty much all of us. And I learned that a lot of white people tried to take their land and stuff, but that was already theirs.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of...
So before Haley learned that about the Lenape people, she didn't know that what she was doing was wrong. And I think that it's okay to not know, but I think it's also very important to be open. You know what just happened with my award, right? With the, so a lot of people are mad because they changed the name of the award. And part of the reason they changed the name of it was because the writer, who is a really great writer in a lot of ways, this was Laura Ingalls Wilder. So she wrote Little House in the Prairie, all the Little House books. And she didn't know that what she was doing was wrong because no one was there saying this is wrong. But
are you sure she didn't know?
I don't know. I mean, we have a different...
What did she say, though? Because I don't know.
She said some not-so-kind things about Black people and about Native people. And so while no one is saying don't read her books, because one thing we don't believe in is censorship, right? You never, mm-hmm. never want to censor a book. But what people were saying was, should we name an award for someone who said that stuff? And I think that some people were like, okay, I get this now. And then some people were like, how dare you change the name of the award? But I think one great thing, and that comes back to what I was saying, the more you read, the more you know, and the more you change.
But she said those things early on before, and they just were allowed to change the name of the award, right?
Yes, because they've been fighting it for a long time.
Yeah. Where did you get these characters from?
I think they were inspired by everything that was happening around me. I think, you know, you and Toshi inspire some traits in my characters. I think that things I read and things I see and things I hope for and things I think about inspire them. But I was writing and rewriting, and I think Tiago was the one who came to me. He was the hardest to figure out. But I think
because you didn't really know about Puerto Rico and you were kind of just saying those typical things, mm-hmm. like the coconuts and the fruits and mm-hmm. stuff like that, but you didn't want to have... It's kind of like the thing with Haley. You don't know that that's kind of a little bit offensive because that's not everything that goes on there.
Exactly. And then what I did was my editor gave it to two librarians to read who are from Puerto Rico, and they were like, this isn't Puerto Rico. You know, this isn't all there is to Puerto Rico. And then I went back and I changed it and I made it his character, where he came from, more cohesive, more like the real place instead of being a lazy head and just writing some stereotypical things. But I learned, you know, someone read it and someone gave me some good feedback. And from that, I learned to create a better narrative. And I think I could have been a cranky person that said, well, this is my experience of Puerto Rico and I'm just going to leave it like this. And so if you want to write something different, you can write your experience. And I'm like, no, I respect that you know more about this than I do. So I'm going to listen to your critiques and edit my book. So Haley, I felt like I knew. Holly, I definitely knew. Amari, I felt like I knew. Esteban, I knew.
What about Ashton?
Ashton, I felt like I got to know the more I rewrote and rewrote and rewrote, and the more I came to love him. He's so sweet.
I don't really like that guy. I don't really like Ashton.
How could you not like Ashton? He's so sweet.
No, but I didn't really like him when he was talking about the water guns and stuff like that.
And why do you think? But why do you think he was saying that?
Because he was like, "Oh, this could have happened to a person that looked like me, but it probably won't."
Mm-hmm. And because he didn't know, right?
I know, but that's still kind of annoying.
Okay, do you have a favorite scene from the book?
Not really, actually. Do you?
So remember when they first got to the art room and their chairs were all kind of everywhere and they were sitting really far away from each other, mm-hmm. and then Holly was like, boys against girls is not fair. And then toward by the end of the book, they were all sitting in a very tight circle and they were surrounding Esteban. Like, that made me really happy. I know I wrote it and it should make me happy and I get to control it, but it made me happy. If you were in the art room, what would you talk about?
Current events, border control, police brutality, stuff like that.
What happy things would you talk about in the art room?
How they stopped ripping kids from their parents.
Yeah. That's interesting. I mean, that's a great thing to talk about. I know a lot of grown-ups who say, oh, you shouldn't write that for kids because they're too young to hear that and they should still be reading fairy tales and they should still be living. What do you think about that?
That's terrible. If you're a kid and your parents do that, then when you go out into the world, you're going to barely know anything about what's happening.
What are you reading now?
When I Was the Greatest, I'm listening to that right now.
Who's it by?
Jason Reynolds.
And how many times have you listened to it?
I don't know.
I think this is at least your 15th time. What do you think it means to be a good listener?
To actually listen and follow the story and stuff like that.
And what does it mean to be a good listener when you're talking to someone?
Pay attention to what the people are saying.
And care, right?
And care about what they're saying, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Do you think you're a good listener?
Mm-hmm.
Do you think a lot of people in our world are good listeners?
No. No.
How do you think people could become better listeners? Like, what if someone was saying something and you didn't agree with it? Would you want to listen to it?
I would still listen to it, but after they were done talking, I would tell them, like, that's not right.
But would you be open because maybe there's a little bit of rightness in what they're saying?
Yeah, I would still be open.
So was there ever a time when you felt that someone harbored you?
There were a lot of times by you cooking for me, letting me stay in the house.
What about your friends?
Making me the team captain at kickball, listening to me, things like that.
So this is the first time our whole family has been part of an audiobook, except Mama.
Yeah.
Well, this is the first time me, you, and Toshi have been part of an audiobook.
Mm-hmm.
How do you think we've done?
I don't know about you guys, but I'm doing great.
I heard Toshi did well, too.
I was about to ask you, why did you start writing? But no, because I already know, because you tell me almost every day. You used to lie a lot, and then your teacher said you can make up stories, and that's kind of like lying. So then you started by doing that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I didn't get in trouble.
Yeah.
Well, I still get in trouble, but for different reasons.
Why did you make the kids in a special learning group? Because it seemed like they were fine and they didn't really need any help with their education.
Do you know kids with learning differences?
Mm-hmm.
Do they always look like they need help?
No, I said they didn't seem like they didn't need help.
Yeah, I think that was part of the point, was to show that we can need help and not look like we need help. Right? Or not seem like we need help. Because even with the six of them, before they got into the art room and you started learning about their lives, they just seem like six regular kids, which they are, six regular kids, and hear all the complexities of their life, right? And the same with learning. We all learn differently. Last question. If you were going to recommend a book to the kids in the art room, what book would you recommend to them?
Any book? By any writer? Okay. Mm-hmm. All American Boys.
Mm-hmm. By who?
Jason Reynolds, my homie.
Why would you recommend All American Boys?
It's funny. It has a lot of the things that they were talking about in it. It has a lot of stuff.
Hmm. You have one last question for me?
No, I think we've covered everything.
Thank you, Jackson Leroy. Thanks for talking to me.
This is Nieme Kamara. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Harbor Me by Jacqueline Woodson. This program was directed by Paula Parker. Executive producer, Sarah Jaffe. Text copyright 2018 by Jacqueline Woodson. Production copyright 2018, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.